This is the Ray Lucia Show.
Coming to the bat for the answers here.
The one show that helps you make better money moves. The program all about your money, your business, and your life.
You guys talk about a lot of really good information that even I can understand.
Call Ray now at 844-RAY-SHOW, 844-RAY-SHOW. This is the Ray Lucia Show.
Thank you very much, and welcome to the one talk show in America that helps you make better money moves. Johnny Dean in the house on the Ray Lucia Show. We welcome our radio and TV viewers from all around the country and all around the world. The program all about your money, your business, and your life. Asset location on the docket today. All kinds of cool stuff. We talked a little bit about capital gains taxes during our last segment or an hour or two ago. But Johnny Dean, you wanted to bring something up. I forget what it was now. It
has to do with the 4%
mortgage. Yeah.
And we've talked about this. And
we were just talking about it on TV.
If you watched it on TV, you heard a mini discussion on it. But I'm going to repeat this for our radio listeners. We're going to expand it a little bit more. The idea that you can only take 4% out of your portfolio, if you take more than that, you're asking for trouble because things happen in the market. And you have sequence of returns, which to me all goes back to having the wrong strategy, first of all. Okay, but setting that aside, the whole idea that you can only take 4% or they've lowered it to 2.9. I've seen 1.9. I saw that back when the 10-year hit 1.3 or something.
Yeah.
So the fact that you can only take 4% of your portfolio really doesn't, it looks great on paper, it looks great in a textbook, but as you've said, Ray, when you're working in with somebody sitting across the desk from you and you're working in real life, totally different story.
It is a totally different story. And we talked about this a week or two ago, as I recall. We had an email from somebody, Carl or something like that.
Yes.
I remember distinctly talking about it. And since
yes.
then, I've gotten some emails from advisors kind of taking the opposite opinion. So I might have to, I might have to school them a little bit because folks, this is what happens when your financial plan is constructed in a finance lab. They go in, I put the glasses on and the green eye shades, and they plug all this data in, and it pops out this spreadsheet that says, oh, you're spending 4.3%. You're going to be eating dog food. This is ludicrous, folks. It's absolutely ludicrous. So I say, sit back, folks. Relax. I'll get it on.
We'll tell you what's what here.
I do want to talk about asset location, though, because that's a really, really interesting topic as well.
Yeah, which is not asset allocation. We want to make that distinction because most people have heard of asset allocation, even if they don't know quite what it is. But they've heard about it. But this is different, and it's just as important.
It is, because with the Trump bill, there's a whole lot of stuff that you need to know, and a lot of the taxes reappear here in the next several years.
Yeah.
So that's another thing that you've got to factor in. But we'll get to that. But let's focus on this so-called 4% rule, which germinated back in 1994. A financial planner dude, a very smart guy, by the name of Bill Benjamin, went into the finance lab and did Monte Carlo simulations that pretty much said, I want a 30-year retirement plan, and I want to be able to spend the maximum amount of money. It's called the safe max rate, the safe maximum amount that I can take out of my portfolio for the next 30 years with a very high degree, like 95% degree of certainty, that I won't be eating dog food. And going through all of that through 30-year random periods, including, you could have had the Great Depression and 2008 back to back to back. Mm-hmm. And so it's a worst case scenario. And that's one of my gripes with it. The other gripe that I have with it, which is far more critical, is the fact that it does not take into account other academic research that we know, very substantial academic research from numerous studies. I could probably quote a dozen, perhaps off the top of my head, that tell us specifically that as you age, you will not spend at the same rate. And the 4% rule takes into account inflation. And it takes into account inflation when inflation was 12% and when inflation was 1%. And trust me, if you have 12% inflation and you're trying to keep pace with that, nobody. And I was in the business when we had these big inflation, you know, the couple of years there where the serious double-digit inflation, not one person ever came to me and said, you know, I read the inflation rate was 11.3% and I've been taking $5,000 a month. Does that mean I need $5,500? Because I got $5,000 sitting in the bank that I didn't spend. Not one time in the many, 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 many years that I did retirement planning for a living. And it was an okay living too, by the way. Not one time did one of my former clients say, I need a raise this year because the inflation rate went up at 3.2%. They never said that.
It's because school and labs are different from real life. I mean, that's exactly how it works. You ever have somebody right out of college who's pretty book smart and they learned all the A's and B's and, you know, it doesn't matter what field you go into. And they come in and they think, hey, I know everything, I'm here. Usually the first thing I tell you is forget all that stuff. Now we're working in the real world. It's the same thing with financial planning.
When my son, who's a really, 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 really smart guy, he's way smarter than his dad, a CPA by training, right?
Yes.
And so when he was young, working at Deloitte & Touche, I'm talking, you know, in his early 20s, he was young and I was doing early morning. Remember I was doing the early morning show on television. I would call him because I knew at 3:30 in the morning he was driving home from work when I was going to work.
Oh, man.
And he would talk to me. He says, well, we got a, you know, like our little investment club here at Deloitte & Touche, and all the young bucks are looking at MACD charts and all that stuff.
Yes.
So a couple of years later, I hired him. And his friends would call him, and they'd still have their little investment club. And he was talking to me about, I forget which stock it was now, but it was a gambling stock. I don't know.
Okay.
Before gambling was even thought of being legal.
Right.
And I gave him $5,000. I said, okay, have at it. Best lesson in financial planning I ever taught my CPA son, who today runs a couple of billion-dollar operation.
Sure.
Yeah. And the reason I did that is because I knew what was going to happen. I knew that he was going to lose, if not all of the money, a good percentage of it.
Of course.
And I knew that if he was going to work in this industry, he had to feel it and taste it.
Absolutely.
Because once you do, it makes an indelible mark in your brain. So now here we are 20 some odd years later, and what he has done is even mind-boggling to me as his dad.
Yeah. Well, but it started with that. It started with experiencing real life. And that's what we're talking about when we talk about this 4% rule. 4% rule isn't a rule. It's a guideline. It gives you a starting point. If I have $1 million, I can use that and say, I can be reasonably certain with a decent strategy that $40,000 a year would work. But then there are so many other factors that come into play that aren't considered. That's only a starting point. You start there. You move along. What are their goals? Do they have pensions coming along? Are they going to need this or that? I mean, to just limit yourself, stop at the starting point is ridiculous.
I met a guy, a really nice guy in Phoenix a few years back. And we were talking strategy. He was really interested in how I went about it. And I asked him how he did it. He said, well, here's what I do. I figure out how much my client wants to spend. And it's like, I don't know. Let's use some numbers here. They have $1 million and they want to spend $60,000 a year.
6%.
That's a 6% rule. And I said, well, how do you do that? He said, well, here's what I do. I get a 6% lifetime income annuity. And I reserve enough money to buy a life insurance policy so that if at the end of the second life or the first life or whatever, a single or a joint, that all of the money that they have, this $1 million, would be replaced by a life insurance policy. In other words, he didn't do any investing. Now, I didn't agree with that. I only agreed with it partially.
Yeah.
But it was a simple strategy. This guy was exceptionally, I shouldn't say was, he's still around, very, very, very successful. And that's all he did with his clients. He kept it simple, stupid. All he did was he said, okay, whatever your need is, we're going to buy a lifetime income annuity that goes to zero when you die. but the life insurance policy is going to pay whenever you die, and it's going to replenish for your kids the $1 million. Now, I could take the other side of that argument and debate him, but there's a lot to be said for simplicity. There's a lot to be said for something that is super, super simple, and that was.
So he wasn't invested in any equities?
He sold no investment. He didn't care about them, because if you think about it, You could create whatever rate of return you want for the legacy.
Oh, absolutely you can.
You could build it in. You can make an 8% rate of return on the insurance, buy a little bit more insurance.
It costs you a little bit more now.
Yeah.
But this is a permanent policy we're talking about. Yeah. This goes back to that whole insurance, invest the rest, or you know.
That's true. Anyway, it was a fascinating discussion. We'll be back with more of the Ray Lucia Show. Stick around. Don't go away. And welcome back, folks. This is the Ray Lucia Show. Johnny Dean in the house. More Californians are considering fleeing the state as they blame sky-high costs, according to a recent survey by the Edelman Intelligence folks, a big marketing and research firm. You know, it's not due to the wildfires, John. It's not due to that. It's not due to the earthquakes. It's due to the fact that the tax rates here up at 13.3% here in California, it's killing people.
I don't think it's the tax rates. That may be part of it. It's more the cost of living. It's the housing. You can't afford a house.
They're all kind of interrelated. I also think a lot of it's the politics, but that's personal.
Well, I don't know about that. People don't think about that on a daily basis. What they're thinking about is, how much is it going to cost me to live there? How much is it costing me currently to live wherever I happen to be? It's not just California. It's the other states. Why are people – the only reason things like housing and all that stuff and tax rates go up is because people are moving in. You got to take care of people. You know, you can't just leave them alone. So that's why when you have an influx of population, you don't have to – you know, it naturally means an increase in prices. That's just the way it is.
It's interesting here. 53% of Californians surveyed are considering fleeing, representing a jump over the 49% a year ago.
I'd like to ask how many actually do.
Well, I think there's a much lower number. I mean,
sure.
Yeah, because
Good
I went
luck.
To Minnesota. It was February, and yeah.
That was it. That's the thing. I mean, you know, you can sit there and gripe about it and complain, but they know it's...
That's Roy.
They know why they're there.
You just described Roy.
Oh, our co-workers
yeah,
who
you
helps...
Yeah, Roy.
Our
good buddy Roy.
For 30
he
years.
Was 10 years ago, he was going to move to Minnesota.
He's going to move to
Remember
Minneapolis.
That?
Yeah,
then he
absolutely.
Went back there a couple of times.
And he said, no, since, now I know why I'm here.
And next thing you know, he's got a new girlfriend. And he's loving life in California.
That's why I say it's one thing to talk. They're only considering it. Ask me on any particular day, am I considering doing something? It depends on my mood.
I'm considering.
So I don't
put
stock in
it. I'm considering talking about asset location right now. What about you?
I'll go along with you on
okay,
that.
Okay, so, and you brought this up earlier. When we discuss asset allocation, that's something that everybody talks about, and we know how important that it is. Asset location is a little bit different, and it's a much, much more sophisticated thing because it's not cut and dry. Everybody's decision on where they locate different assets or investments is going to be different. That's why I cannot give generic advice in that regard, because not only do you have to look at your personal situation today, your tax bracket, the investments that you have, and so forth, but you must also be able to forecast into the future. You were bringing up someone's Social Security benefits. Do they have real estate? Are they going to be selling capital gain assets or selling a business? And all of that good stuff. But where you locate various assets can make a big, huge difference in the net bottom line.
You say locate. Now, for people who don't know what we're talking about, you have, a few different choices as to where to locate. Let's explain what we mean by where you locate your assets. It has to do with the taxability.
Okay, well, let's just look at the different ways that you can invest, all right? And it's actually more than three, but you can invest in CDs, government bonds, money market funds, corporate bonds, loans of sort, any sort, and the earnings that you get are all taxed at ordinary income. So that's a post-tax investment that produces ordinary income. Those assets can be located in your personal account, or many would say they should be located inside of a qualified account because the tax treatment's exactly the same.
Like an IRA.
Whether you own the asset personally or own it in an IRA, the interest earnings, whenever it comes out, will be taxed at ordinary income. Let's stay with non-qualified money, that is post-tax money. You can also invest in stocks. Now, stocks create dividends. Those dividends are subject to a different tax rule. They're subject to the capital gains tax rules, whereby you could pay as little as a 0% tax or as high as like 23.8% tax, depending on how much other income you have. Now, individuals that are in moderate to low income tax brackets might want to own their dividend paying stocks in their taxable account if they had their druthers, because they may be, it may be a tax-free muni bond to them. Think about this. You can go out and buy a tax-free muni bond and get 3%. Or you can buy a dividend-paying mutual fund that pays 3%. If that 3% dividend hits whilst you're in the 15% bracket,
12.
You're 12% right. bracket.
That's
I'm
okay.
still living last year.
That's okay.
2 years ago, actually. Now,
it's been 2 years.
Wow, time flies. So you would circumvent paying any part of that 12% tax. It's a huge deal. So dividends, maybe you want to locate them in your personal taxable brokerage, if you will, account. Now, if you have a mutual fund that's trading stock all the time, that's got a lot of turnover, that's creating short-term gains, not so much. If you have a REIT, not so much. That's 1099 money. That's all subject to ordinary income tax. The ordinary income tax investments might better be located inside of the IRA.
Or potentially in that case, maybe the Roth IRA, because that's another location I would suggest. You have the traditional IRA, you have the personal side, and you have potentially tax-free growth in the Roth.
Yeah, so here's where I have differing opinions.
Okay.
Because most, myself included, would argue, in particular if you're younger, that your growth assets should be in the Roth IRA. That's where you're going to get the most growth, and that might make some sense. However, I would also argue, because I have this argument with myself. Have you ever done that? You look in the mirror and you have these arguments? I do it all the time.
Yeah. All the time.
So I would argue with myself and say, self, I know that makes sense intuitively. The maximum amount of growth should be inside my Roth, because that money grows tax-free and I can pull the money out tax-free. But then I say, you know, it would be nice if I had something that was income producing, that I didn't have to sell shares. And if I did sell shares, maybe I'd only get hit with a much lower tax, or if I could construct my taxable income properly, it could be zero. So maybe I want my higher yielding investments in my Roth IRA, because perhaps I want to do some blending when I get to Social Security time, so that I don't have to pay tax on 85% of my Social Security, because I could take tax-free money out of my Roth. You see how I kind of go through this, and I will either confuse myself or argue with myself over those decisions.
Never quite coming to a conclusion until somebody comes to you with a goal and says, here's what I want to have happen.
Then I can do it perfectly.
This is why it's good to have both sides. This is why it's good to be on the fence, because it depends on your goal. Oh, you want this? We're going to go this way. We're going to go the Roth way, because this is your goal here. It's better not to just shut one side of it out.
Then there's the so-called tax deferred as opposed to pre-tax. This you would find in, say, an annuity. So why would somebody put money into an annuity? Well, I'll tell you why. You can buy a CD and get 3%. You can buy a fixed annuity probably and get 4%. And when you take the money out of an annuity, it's taxable, but it's deferred while you're letting it grow. If you're in a lower tax bracket when you take the money out, you just gamed the system legally. So there you go.
Location, location, location.
I've heard that before. we'll take a quick break and come back. It's the Ray Lucia Show.
We're on.
Welcome back. I know we're on. We're just Johnny Dean is talking here. We're just chatting, and you keep bringing up stuff. I'm ready to go on to another topic.
I know. You know what? It's me. I get hooked on one thing, topic, and I think we need to talk about it. Couple things. Somebody asked me during the break, and we were emailed actually by somebody who wanted me to just clarify because they thought, well, we said if you're in the 12% bracket, tax bracket, ordinary
actually,
income
tax. Actually, I said 15,
bracket.
But I was wrong.
It's all right. Well, I wasn't going to bring that
no,
up.
No, it's okay. It's okay.
It was 15
I live in the
year.
Past.
It's 15 for a year.
I live in the past. I can still throw a tight spiral, running
going
to the left.
80 yards.
60 yards.
60. All right, still at 60. No increase for inflation on that.
Uh-huh.
All right. If you're in, the 12% bracket, as long as you stay in that bracket, you are in a 0% capital gains tax. But here's the thing that I think a lot of people don't realize. Let's say I got $2,000 of room, and I'm $2,000 under in the 12% bracket. If I made $2,000 more, I'm in the next bracket. But I've got, $50,000 of capital gains. Just because I'm in the 12% bracket, which puts me in a 0% capital gains bracket, doesn't mean I can take all $50,000 and all of a sudden all of it is as a 0% tax bracket. $2,000 in my example will be in the zero. The rest will be in the 15%.
And this is one of the reasons why planning is so critically important.
And it's confusing.
Because if you had the ability to reduce your income by putting more money away in an IRA, or perhaps you're a business owner, you do a defined benefit plan, or whatever the case may be, then you may be able to sell more of that asset in the 0% tax bracket.
It's just stuff that you got to think about, or at least your planner should be thinking about it. Not you don't necessarily have to, but make sure that your advisor.
The numbers are taxable income of around $78,000, somewhere in that ballpark. So you get a 24.4 standard deduction this year.
You know about for single or married?
A married couple.
Married, okay.
I only talk to married couples.
Okay.
You're single, I don't want to talk to you.
It's not that much less for a single, actually, but
yeah. Singles like almost $40,000.
Yeah, okay, it's not
plus
half,
plus but a $12,000. So you
right,
can make
okay,
like,
but let's stick with married.
Up to $52,000 if you're single. Well, we can say it doesn't matter, and you make $30,000 of income. You've got $22,000 left or so mm-hmm. of capital gains. If you have a $40,000 gain in an asset, 22 will be at 0%. And the other 18 or whatever is going to be at 15%.
Right. Just understand that.
That's
it's
how
to
she works.
Some people might think, great, they sell $100,000 worth of capital gains assets thinking it's in the 0%. And no, it got bumped up into the next.
I don't
or
get
even,
that as much now as we used to when they first changed it. But it's a good point. Thanks for bringing it up.
Just thought I would. I like to clarify things. Here's the other thing. All right. This says gamma factor on it. I'm reading something from.
Gamma factor? They're talking about the Morningstar study.
Yes, it's
alpha, beta, now gamma.
I think this is from Fidelity. I'm not sure.
So what? I see arrows and charts and all that. Now, you're not an
you
arrow.
You love
and
this
chart
stuff. You, I'm not. I don't like it. But I maybe you can.
What
comment
do you need? You need
this.
Me to interpret?
Well,
it?
They're talking about asset location, and it says asset location in action.
Well, that's what we were talking about a few minutes ago.
Yes, we were.
And I thought we did a pretty good job of explaining what it is.
We did a great job.
We did not talk about the gamma factor, though.
Should we? Because they bring it up here. Makes it look like it's important.
That goes back to a study that was done by Morningstar, where they looked at the value an advisor adds to the mix. The study was done by Blanchett, maybe Kaplan, I don't know, a bunch of guys
yes,
at Morningstar.
You got that right.
I did?
In September of 2012.
Okay, so it's in there. See that? So what they did is they looked at what an advisor could bring to the table. It was in response to a study that was done by Vanguard on, quote, advisor alpha. But what Morningstar did is they didn't look at performance, like how much of a better rate of return. They looked at income. So the gamma part was the fact that a good advisor could generate something in the neighborhood, if I'm remembering the study, 22% more income by being a best practices advisor. And some of the things that were in that, incidentally, and you have it in front of you, I don't know, but
yes,
annuity recommendations, asset location, and all that stuff, right?
They talked about something called liability relative optimization. Now, that's a fancy word for what we were just talking about, a sort of buckets, if you will, strategy.
Yeah.
Where you time segment your assets to your liabilities. Match
yeah,
it
that's
up.
A withdrawal strategy. Mm-hmm. But if you match short-term assets to short-term needs and long-term assets to long-term needs, then you have a greater chance of success because you'll be circumventing the sequence of returns risk.
Right, which really sounds bookish and wonky. Bookish and wonky, attorneys at law.
Yeah.
That's, but you know, the fact that it sounds that way doesn't make it any less important.
It's
something
it's
that
actually,
your advisor should be
it's
doing.
It's actually quite simple.
It is.
When you draw it out on a piece of paper.
Yes.
But when you're talking about liability optimization and all that stuff, those are just fancy terms for put your money in a safe bucket.
Put your money in a safe bucket for the short-term money and,
right.
and all that. They have other stuff here that are factor into this whole gamma. Without me getting too specific, it has to do with things like hedging inflation, tax-efficient investing. That's another thing that people don't always think about tax-efficient investing. And this all goes back into asset location that we were talking about.
Well, tax-efficient investing. People make the mistake. I'm going to go buy municipal bonds. I'm in the 12% tax bracket,
yeah.
And I'm going to go buy municipal bonds. I go out 15 years. I get a 3% rate of return.
You're saying tax-free municipal
bond. Yeah, tax-free municipal bond. I get a 3% tax-free rate of return. When if I put that money into something that paid me 5% taxable, I'm still significantly better off. So why are you buying the muni?
It doesn't make sense.
It doesn't make sense.
You stand for a better growth chance in say, the dividend-paying
stock. If I've talked to somebody once, I've talked at least 100 times about that very subject. I'll give you one example, all right? We talked about MIGAs the other day, multi-year guaranteed annuity contracts or fixed annuities. Now, if you take the income, remember we were just talking about how you can defer the income?
Mm-hmm.
If you take the income, it's all ordinary income, right? So you could buy a 15-year muni and get 3%, or you could buy a 4-year MIGA and get 4%. I'm making that up, all right? But let's just say. So if you're saving the taxes in 3%, you're net 3. If you're in the 12% income tax bracket, what's 12% of 4%?
It's like that. It's
like 4.8.
I don't know.
So it's a half of a percent. So after taxes in the MIGA, you're making 3.5, and you're making 3 in the municipal bond. The municipal bond has a duration of 12 years, and the other one's got a duration of 3 years. So which one do you want? This is my point. It's not rocket science, but we sometimes make it rocket science, or because it's tax-free, it's got to be really good. It's just like the lady that I'm talking to after the show today. She has some annuities she's going to pay penalties and taxes on, $2,000 of gain. She's probably in the lowest of tax brackets. So 12% of $2,000 is $240. And then there's another, you know, $200 penalty. So for $400, she gets to take her $50,000 out and go buy a house. And she's really, really freaked out about it.
About the penalty?
About the paying the taxes and the penalty. So and my point is going to be, and this is the one whose husband passed away. My point is going to be, how important is it for you to have the house? Is it worth $400 or $500 to get the house that you really want and you really need? It's going to make you feel more secure as long as she can afford it. And I haven't gotten into all that. She's just asking me about taxes. And sometimes we've got to be able to see the forest for the trees.
This is what real life financial planning is all about, by the way. It may not make sense. I mean, from a numbers standpoint, in this particular example, why would you ever want to pay a 10% penalty or whatever and pay the taxes, even if, you know, she's probably not in a high tax bracket, but the 50 grand is going to make a difference. If it's going to cost her $400 or $500 or whatever it is out of the 50 grand to have the money, then it really, in a real life situation, makes sense to do it.
Let me explain why it would make even more sense. She's 57. She waits 2 years, no penalty, still have the taxes.
Yes.
All right. Still got to pay the taxes. So she doesn't buy the home. She wants to move to Nevada. She doesn't buy the home for 2 years. The home's a $250,000 home, make
whatever.
Up a number. And the property values over the next 2 years go up 4%. That's 10 grand. That's $10,000. So for $500, she's given up $10,000 and has to live in some dumpy apartment while she waits for the penalty. I mean, that's my point.
Well, it's not even 500 because she'd pay the taxes either way. It's
right.
Really 200.
It's 200.
It's 200 because in her example,
that's right.
$2,000 is going to be
penalized. She's very sweet. I have never met her. We've just emailed and texted,
you know,
back and forth.
You can overthink this stuff. You can, as you said, the cliche of the forest and the trees. It really can blind you. And the question is, what is your goal?
Are you criticizing my use of cliches again?
Hey, listen, all I'm saying is you should start putting your nose to the wheel and your ear to the grindstone and stop using cliches.
Because they could grow to the sky.
Because they could grow to the sky. Don't you ever think about that? I mean, waste not, want not, Ray. A penny saved is a penny earned.
Emails next. That's a cliche on this program. Don't go away. Oh, welcome back, folks. It is the Ray Lucia program.
Oh,
glad
man.
To have you on board. It's been an awesome hour, Johnny Boy.
I hope our viewers and listeners are having as much fun as we are.
I'm having a blast.
It's one of those
things.
Do
appreciate.
Let's see. There was something I was going to bring up, and I can't remember. I got some emails. Do we want to just jump right in?
Let's hit it, fellas. We'll do some emails.
I know we were going to talk about this millennial thing, wasting money. We'll save that for another time. But I got some people that want to ask some questions, and I've been putting this off for the last couple hours.
All right, go.
Pat, this should be an easy one, says, I want to give $100,000 to both of my adult children. It's nice. What tax considerations should I be aware of? Are there any exemptions or other ways to minimize the tax? Here's one that a lot of people get wrong or they're confused about.
Because, Pat, you could give each of your kids about $5.5 million. You wouldn't have to worry about taxes. Here's the thing. You do have to file a gift tax return, in theory. But when they changed the estate tax rules, now and they made them like cumulative. So husbands and wives can make a gift to anybody they want, including John Dean, and he would gladly take it. For what is it, $11.2 million this year?
$11.2 million, that's per person. If you're a married couple, it's $22 million.
It's just amazing number. So you don't have to worry about that. For $100,000, God bless you. Give them both $100,000. If you choose to file Form 709 to notify the government that in the unlikely event you win $100 million in the lottery, you might have to give up that 11-point-whatever-million-dollar credit, then the answer is yes, file. But I'm not a tax accountant, so I'm not going to tell you not to file, but I don't see any purpose in doing it. Give them the money and don't worry about it. There's no penalties. There's no nothing that no penalty for failure to file a 709 that I know of.
Well, because the only reason you would need to file the 709 is down the road if you're ultimately worth die with more than more than the, whatever the estate tax is amount. And it's $22 million something for a married couple. Who knows what it'll be in 5 years? It'll be $30 million the way they've been raising it.
Yeah, so, then we don't know what's going to happen later on, though, because the Democrats, if they get in, they're going to want to change that.
Well, they may, but they're not going to bring it down. It was $650,000 for a long time, and that's when you had to be careful.
Johnny,
it was $1 million.
When I first started in this business, it was $60,000. That was the exemption. You got $60,000, yeah. And you paid federal estate taxes on anything over that. And it raised up to $650 million, too. And now it's like, you know, nobody listening to this program or few people listening to this program have to worry about estate taxes.
Well, $60,000 in, what was that, the 70s was, that was a lot. But I mean, yeah, and then you had to pay taxes on that. So it's basically a moot point. It's gone away. So don't worry about it, Pat. Yeah, you're right. You have advised on the air. File the 709 if you want.
You start
you're supposed
a statute.
To,
you do
after
start
15,000.
You do start the statute of limitations running. So if, in fact, there's some questionable gifting or whatever that you're doing and you don't file the form, the IRS can come back and get you. That's the reason to file.
Well,
I can't think of...
But the only thing they can do, though, is say, I mean, there's no penalty for not filing a 709 that I know of. Maybe there is. But anything over $15,000...
I could give you an example.
All right.
You make a gift of some income-producing property to kids or whatever, but... You have some contract with the kids that says, no, you're going to, you know, give me all that money back or something like
that.
Well, so they're,
yeah,
they're
okay, I can
see. Stuff like that.
I can see. All right. Don't worry about it, Pat. Let's get to the next one here. Victoria, I'm going to inherit an annuity later this year. I'm 57 years old, but will I be required to take money out of it like a required minimum distribution? And what taxes will I have to pay if I simply withdraw money from it for my own use?
Okay, how much of an annuity did she say?
Didn't say. Doesn't have an amount. But
so if you're 57 years old, is that what she said? 57?
That's
yes. Another 57-year-old.
Yes.
You've got the same problem as the other 57-year-old we were talking about earlier.
Yep.
Because if you take money out, there's no required minimum distribution. You're going to pay tax, period. Because if you take the money out, you're going to pay ordinary income on all of the gain. And you're going to have to pay a 10% federal penalty. So you have $10,000 of gain. You've got $10,000 of ordinary income, another $2,000 in federal penalties. If you're in the state of California or another state with a state penalty tax, you might have another couple hundred bucks in taxes. And there's not an easy way out of that. Now, did she say she was inheriting it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
You do have the ability to spread the payments out over 5 years. And that would be highly recommended. So you take payments over 5 years. If you don't need the money, then you're not going to be, you won't have bracket creep per se, because if you take 50,000 bucks out in 1 year, chances are it might catapult you into a higher income tax bracket.
Oh, it will.
But if in fact you take 10,000 out a year for 5 years, it maybe won't. So those are the requirements, but you got to pay tax on it.
But she'll still have the penalty, right, at age 57. She'll have to wait till she's 59 and a half, correct?
No. If she takes it over the five-year period, or...
They will dispense with the penalty?
I forgot that it was a death benefit thing. There won't be a penalty if you inherit it on death.
Oh, okay.
There's not going to be a penalty. There's going to be taxes.
Same thing like with an IRA. When you inherit an IRA, of course, people, when you inherit an IRA, if you're not a spouse, you do have a required minimum distribution, even if you're 20 years old. And so obviously they're not going to penalize you if they're requiring you to take money out.
Again, if you took it out for 5 years, you can circumvent the penalty.
On the...
on an inherited IRA, or in some cases, divorce and all that stuff.
Well, yeah. You're talking about a penalty as far as the
10% penalty tax.
On the annuity, you're saying.
On an inheritance.
Yes, on an inheritance, yeah. Inheritances work a little differently. Spousal, going from one spouse dies, the other spouse inherits it, they have a lot more leeway. They have options with IRAs where they can put it in their own name or leave it in.
I've seen that blow up in somebody's face too before, because here's what happens. The case that I can recall is an individual whose spouse had passed away. She was, I think, 38 or 40 or something like that at the time. And her advisor had her roll the spouse's $400,000, whatever it was, 401k or whatever,
into
her own IRA, and she needed income. And I said, well, you know, we've got a situation where the income amount that you need exceeds what you could do under a 72T election.
So you're looking at penalties.
If she had left that money in the spouse's IRA or created a beneficiary IRA, she could take any amount of money out that she needed without having to pay the penalty. Still got to pay the taxes. So I would say to anybody, don't listen to us. Get yourself a really good financial advisor, because we don't have the whole story, even though we have a pretty good handle on most of this stuff.
We're done.
We are. Folks, thank you so much for tuning. Tell your friends and neighbors, dogs and cats, about the program. Now go out and make it a blessed day. Bye-bye.
You're listening to The Ray Lucia Show, bringing you the best in money information, answering questions about your biggest financial challenges, talking about your money, your business, and your life. Ray Lucia is not a registered representative of or affiliated with any securities brokerage or investment advisory firm. The views and opinions expressed by Ray and his guests are not necessarily those of this station or its sponsors and should not be construed as legal, tax, or investment advice. You should always consult with the appropriate advisors before making any financial decisions. Ray is available to take your questions online at raylucia.com.
Forget about it.